On the 11th of March in 2011, Japan was rocked by the fourth largest earthquake in recorded history. It pushed the Pacific floor upwards by at least 50 metres, some estimate almost double that. Yet the quake itself was just the start of a chain of catastrophic events that rocked Japan. A tsunami slammed into the country's northeast coast less than an hour after the earthquake shock, with waves reaching over 40 metres in some valleys. Around 20,000 people were killed or lost forever under the waves. But the tsunami also surged over the protective seawall of Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power station, triggering multiple meltdowns. It was the world's worst nuclear accident since Chernobyl 25 years before, and caused the greatest radioactive contamination of the world's oceans in history. Covering it all for the ABC was our North Asia correspondent Mark Willacy, who received a Walkley Award for his reports. Mark's written a new book about the twin disasters, seen through the eyes of witnesses, victims, and the players who were calling the shots at the time in the government and in the TEPCO power company. Mark Willacy is in our breakfast studios in Sydney. Mark, good morning. Welcome to breakfast.
Thanks, Fran.
Mark, you've visited Fukushima region many, many times. Can you just give us an update first on where the community around it is at and where the cleanup is at?
Well, the cleanup, Fran, is still going on. Wherever you drive around that nuclear plant, you'll see these giant blue bags, and they're about the height of a man. They contain tons and tons of topsoil, and what they're doing is they're basically scraping the topsoil of every square millimetre of that dirt around Fukushima, and that's going to take many, many, many years. So the communities right around the plant are still abandoned. In fact, there's still 150,000 people who are sort of classified as nuclear refugees who are living in what they like to call temporary apartments. But for many of those, of course, they won't be temporary apartments. They'll be sort of permanent residences, I suppose.
And we're talking about how many people in how wide an area?
Well, you're talking about people who lived within, say, a 20-kilometre zone around the Fukushima nuclear plant. But you're also talking about people outside that official evacuation area because, you know, obviously radiation doesn't spread in concentric circles. There's sort of hot spots. It's driven by wind. It's guided by topography. So even 30 kilometres away from the plant, there are still some amazing hot spots there. When you drive through there, when I've been reporting for the ABC, and we've got the Geiger counter sitting on the dashboard of the car, It really does screech at you at times. So, you know, as I say, 150,000 people still living in temporary apartments. And I'd say, you know, there's talk of at least half, up to 100,000 people who probably will never be able to go home or not for the next few decades at least.
And Mark, what's the latest on the removal of the fuel rods, the plant itself?
Well, that's a good question, Fran. You know, TEPCO, the company that's in charge of the plant, recently announced it's going to actually remove that melted fuel, the former fuel rods, if you like, ahead of schedule. But that's not going to be until 2020. It's going to take them at least 40 years to decommission that plant. They don't even know where that melted fuel really is in at least two of the reactors. And TEPCO, when I was talking to them for the book, admitted to me that the fuel in at least one of those reactors has melted through what's the pressure called the pressure vessel. It's actually eating through the concrete underneath that pressure vessel, which is, and that's called the containment vessel, and it's eating slowly through that that concrete. Although it's saying that the TEPCO is saying, look, we've cooled it, hopefully it's not eating through it any further, but they really don't know much more than that.
Seems they didn't know a lot at all, which is a large part of the book. I'll come to that in a moment, but just to stay with the power of the tsunami of that moment, Mark, the world watched on TV. In fact, a lot of the people in your book saw things unfold from inside a house or inside a bunker because this was really the first earthquake and tsunami that we've been able to watch live as it happened. You've spoken to many eyewitnesses about that moment. What story or what account stands out most from all of those for you, the account of that actual moment of the realisation of what was happening?
I think it was the story of a fisherman that I'd known before the disaster, and I'd been to his home before the disaster. I'd got to know him quite well, and he's quite a, I suppose you'd call him a fairly practical bloke. And 2 days, what people don't realise is 2 days before the March 11 earthquake, there was a major foreshock. What they now know was a foreshock. It was a 7.2 magnitude earthquake. And all these fishermen, they're sort of trained. They jump on their boats and they head straight out to sea. So that had happened 2 days before. And then on March 11, when this massive earthquake hit, he just said to his wife, "You stay here, I'm going to save the boat. Now, his wife said, okay, I'll stay here, even though she lived by the shore. And he jumped in his boat and he headed out to sea. And he said he got towards the mouth of the bay and he saw this perfect wave. It was this grey wave against a white sky. It was a very sort of ugly sort of day in northern Japan that day. And he said he climbed over this wave and he said 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 metres. And he got over the back of this wave and he turned around and he looked at his hometown and he said, by the time that reaches the shore, it's going to be massive. And then he saw this explosion as it hit the coast and it hit the town. He thought it was like a nuclear bomb, but it was actually the wave hitting these buildings and they just imploded. And he just then thought, wow, did I do the right thing? Because my wife's still back there, and thankfully his wife survived. But many of the people he knew, and I'd met his friends, many of them, they didn't survive. And he watched it unfold.
And the book follows a number of stories, personal stories, and the realization, the fear, the bravery, and the grief, the aftermath. And I want to come to some of those, but really, this story beyond the personal is also a story about corruption and lying and manipulation of the highest order by the Japanese nuclear industry and to some degree the government. I mean, you tell the story of how TEPCO, the energy company that ran the plant, the Fukushima plant, bribes communities with billions of dollars so they can build their reactors in places where they shouldn't be because of the seismic activity. Then they ignored warnings, they hid the evidence that warned them that there could be an event like this. They shielded that from the public and didn't really make provision. They didn't even really have a proper emergency plan when it hit, did they?
No, they didn't. And in fact, 3 years before this disaster, there was a simulation done of what would happen if a major earthquake hit off that coastal region of Japan. And that simulation showed that there'd be a tsunami of about 15.7 metres that would hit the coast. And that is exactly what happened. You know who did that simulation? TEPCO did the simulation. What did TEPCO do with that information? It put it on a shelf. And about a week before the tsunami hit, it decided to release that information to the nuclear regulator. Now, by that time, really, it was too late. And I spoke to TEPCO about that, and they said, well, yeah, we did the simulation, but we thought, wow, that's a really worst-case scenario. It probably never happened. And you think, well, why do the simulation? So that was the sort of environment that I suppose the Japanese population was living in. They had these nuclear regulators that would let the nuclear companies do what they liked. They didn't push the nuclear companies. The nuclear companies were in bed with the government. They have been for years, and the government never pushed them either. So it was this cozy little cabal of interests. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And, you know, you might do the simulation. It might show this massive wave will hit. What do you do with it? You put it on a shelf.
And the willful denial just went on and on right to the very top. I mean, even when the Prime Minister, Naoto Kan, the disaster had struck, he's a bit of an action man, as you paint him, and he wants to pull his sleeves up and get his hands dirty. He gets in the chopper, goes to Fukushima. Even he can't get answers. There's one point where he's back in his office. He's watching Reactor 3, I think it is, explode. There's black smoke. Naoto Kan, you say, what's going on, asked Kan. There was silence. No one had any answer. But then over at TEPCO, when they're watching it too, they know what's going on, but the president of TEPCO basically says, well, don't tell them that, tell them something different. Basically, tell them it was a hydrogen explosion.
Yeah.
So there's willful denial and lying going on here at the highest levels.
That's right.
Even the Prime Minister can't get the answers.
That's right. Naoto Kan was a very interesting man. You know, he's this Prime Minister, and he's been sort of praised in the Western media for being a bit of an action man, but in the Japanese media, he was roundly denounced. He was very un-Japanese. He went in there, he wanted answers, he wanted to kick some heads. So, look, I don't know how history's going to judge him. You know, he's been accused of meddling in the disaster, but I suppose what I discovered in the book is, why wouldn't you meddle? You're not getting the answers you want. TEPCO were telling him nothing because they didn't know anything. The chairman of the company was on a junket in China leading some media executives around, which was standard practice, and the president was off on a sightseeing tour of Western Japan. The company was when this happened. Naoto Kan's trying to get a grip on it, and he really, really struggled. And he admitted to me that he just didn't believe what he was being told. And I suppose from that perspective, jumping on a helicopter, going up to Fukushima and trying to find out was a pretty heroic act. But in the Japanese media, he was denounced for meddling.
It's 16 past 8 on Breakfast. Our guest this morning is Mark Willacy. Mark is the ABC's North Asia correspondent, I'm sure you know that, and he was there really for every horrifying hour as the Japan's earthquake, tsunami and the nuclear crisis unfolded. He's written a book about it called Fukushima. Mark, it's a terrific book, and what makes it terrific is all the individuals you've spoken to, many ordinary Japanese people who found themselves in the wake, in the path of the tsunami or in the path of the radiation that followed as the Fukushima plant went into meltdown. And there's many stories of bravery. There's also many tragedies, the grief, and as you write, which many just found it impossible to live with.
Yeah, I think the thing that moved me the most was the story of a man called Norio Kimura, and he's a pig farmer in Fukushima, and when the wave hit, or when the earthquake happened rather, he was told, look, there's a 3-metre tsunami coming, and he said he did a mental calculation. He said, well, my house is about 6 metres above sea level, it'll be okay. And all these pigs at his farm had fallen through the slats into the waste area, and he spent hours picking these pigs up out of the waste area, and then he went home to his house thinking, you know, we've dodged a bullet here, and he got home and it was just completely destroyed, and he lost his father, he lost his wife, he lost his daughter. And not only that, he had one surviving daughter. Not only that, because he lived next door to the nuclear plant, he then had to evacuate with his daughter out of there. And to talk to these people and to see the strength that they have, you know, obviously the Japanese are often described as stoic, and it's a bit of a stereotype, but he searched and searched and searched for his family. And he said to me, when I, you know, did a lot of interviews with him, he said to me at the end, I'll never forget it, he said, I can forgive the natural disaster, but I'll never forgive the nuclear disaster. And I suppose that really resonated with me.
Yeah, and then that grief is one story too of a woman who was dislocated from her farm life, her happy life, because of the radiation and not because of the tsunami, and she just ultimately couldn't cope. And the number of suicides that are still occurring in the wake of this is awful. But the story that the image that you give us, Mark, of the mother who actually went out and got the bulldozer license so she could keep trying to clear away the mud and debris around the school and the area around the school where her daughter had perished. She just was not going to stop until she'd found her daughter's body.
That's right. And her father-in-law had told her, look, give up, she's gone. And this woman, as you said, she was told by the police and the firefighters, we're going to wind up the search. This is many weeks after the tsunami. And they said, well, look, if you go out and get a bulldozer license, we'll give you a bulldozer. Because the area is so huge that you couldn't search it by hand. So that's what she did. And, you know, her daughter's body was found many months later, you know, floating off the Pacific in the end. And she said to me, you know, I will keep searching because there are other people whose children died. We still need to find these people. Mm. You know, there's that word closure, which I think is a bit of a cliche, but that is exactly what she wanted. And her daughter was one of 74 kids that was washed away at this school. It was the only school where there were fatalities. And that in itself, people talk about Fukushima being a cover-up. That was a cover-up because it was preventable.
There's cover-up on cover-up. Mark, what about the health cost from this, the ongoing health cost, the Fukushima 50, the workers who had to stay back and deal with the plant melting down, others caught in their zone? Is there any stats or any evidence yet of the radiation damage to people's health?
No, there isn't yet, Fran. They're doing thyroid testing of children in Fukushima. I believe they've done a couple of 100,000 tests, and in the book, I talked to a parent whose son was found with a lump on his thyroid, and she says, well, look, you know what they told me? They said, come back in 2014 and we'll check him again. Mm. And she said, look, I don't know whether it was caused by the nuclear accident. They're not telling me anything. And I went and spoke to the guy who was running the thyroid program, and he went, yeah, look, we probably should tell people individually what it means, but we just simply don't have the time. So there's a lot of confusion about what's going on. And in fact, the United Nations recently said, look, they do not expect any long-term cancer effects because of Fukushima. And the reason for that, they say, was because there was an early evacuation. So that criticism of the Prime Minister, Nato Khan, for being a meddling politician, well, maybe he did the right thing by pulling people out very early. But look, it'll take years to work out, Fran, what's going on with health effects.
And Mark, what about yourself? As we've been speaking, some listeners have contacted us and they want to know if you're concerned about your health. You've been in and out of this Fukushima disaster zone ever since it occurred. You talked about having the Geiger count in the car. Are you worried?
Look, it's a good question. I've sort of kept an eye on my health, and obviously it's a story that we have to cover, and to cover these first drafts of history, you've got to be where history is being made. So you've got to go up there. But yeah, look, I've been asked by young journalists, how did you approach this? And I said, well, it's pretty hard. I couldn't really talk to anyone who covered Chernobyl. It's not exactly something that we cover often, a nuclear meltdown. So It is something to keep an eye on, Fran. And look, I've got a very dedicated wife who tells me when it's time not to go to Fukushima. And the ABC also is very good and says, look, if you don't feel like going and you're worried about your staff, don't go in. So we do have a break now and then, and we do monitor our health. And so far, so good.
Well, so far so good. Let's hope so. You must have seen an awful lot of horrible things too in this time, so I'm sure it's been tough personally. But this is a terrific first draft of history, Mark. You've really spoken to all the players, the people who experienced as citizens, who've seen had their lives changed or ended, or, you know, the people, the victims of that and the grief, but also the power brokers, who many of them were too long in their bunkers and too long denying what was going on. It's a terrific work. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Fran. Good to talk.
Mark Willacy. Mark Willacy is our ABC's North Asia correspondent, and his book, Fukushima, Japan Tsunami and the Inside Story of the Nuclear Meltdown, is published by Macmillan. It's 8:22 on Breakfast.